It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in overcast and breezy Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 43 degrees. At the airport, they indicate they have steady southeast winds at 21 miles per hour, gusting to 30. And the Weather Service is calling for gusty winds. They're only calling for 25 mile per hour gusts. But they are also calling for rain for the rest of the day, overnight, till about 10 a.m. tomorrow, followed by scattered showers. That rain could be quite heavy at times tonight. Somewhere between 1 and 2 inches is possibly going to fall this evening. Coming up on the Midday Report, Alaska veterans reflect on past wars as they look forward to the Iran war. Alaskans and pull tabs. They've been together for a while. Now they're debating whether electronic pull tabs might juice up the pull tab industry. And the Alaska legislature is asking for some flexibility from the federal government as it goes to transform rural health care.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. Supreme Court is allowing an additional 3-day extension to patients' telemedicine access to the abortion pill mifepristone. The justices are seeking time to decide key issues of a lawsuit out of Louisiana. The state argues that the FDA's decision to allow telemedicine access undermines Louisiana's abortion ban. A federal appeals court agreed, but the nation's top court paused a decision. President Trump is expressing pessimism about the fate of the ceasefire between the U.S. and Iran. It's been in question after recent attacks by both sides. The U.S. and Iran have traded ceasefire proposals, but still no agreement. Here's NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben.
Trump is not putting a positive spin on where things are.
I would say the ceasefire is on massive life support, where the doctor walks in and says, sir, your loved one has approximately a 1% chance of living.
He did not elaborate on what might end that ceasefire or what would come next. He said he didn't even finish reading Iran's latest response to a U.S. ceasefire proposal, calling it a, quote, piece of garbage. Trump has expressed disappointment with the negotiation process before and threatened military action, but has so far not followed through on those threats. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, The White House.
President Trump is slated to meet with Chinese leader Xi Jinping this week in Beijing. Trump had rescheduled that visit to China after the war with Iran broke out. The issue of the war is likely to be a main topic, but NPR's Deepa Shivaram reports the AI race is also expected to come up.
When it comes to AI technology from American companies like OpenAI, Anthropic, and Google, experts say those models are better than what China's putting out. The U.S. is, by some estimates, about 6 to 12 months ahead of China. So Trump is right that the U.S. is leading the AI race in that regard. But where China is inching ahead is on AI adoption, how integrated AI is in their society, and how accessible their AI products are. In the meeting this week, Trump and Xi are expected to talk about global risk management when it comes to the rise of AI. Deepa Shivaram, NPR News.
More than 20 countries are preparing to receive or are treating people from a cruise ship that was stricken with a hantavirus outbreak. The United States received 18 individuals. One American tested positive for the rodent-borne disease. But the Assistant Secretary for Health, Admiral Brian Christine, says the risk to the general public is low.
The Andes variant of this virus does not spread easily, and it requires prolonged close contact with someone who is already symptomatic. Even so, we have taken this situation very seriously from the very start.
16 people are being monitored in Nebraska. 2 are in Georgia. This is NPR News.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
For KMXT News, I'm Terry Haynes. The Alaska legislature is asking the federal government for some flexibility when it comes to implementing a massive program intended to transform rural health care across the state. Alaska received $272 million from the federal Rural Health Transformation Program, part of the One Big Beautiful Bill that passed last summer, putting it on track to receive nearly $1.4 billion over 5 years. It's the largest per capita grant for any state in the $50 billion federal program. But State Senator Forrest Dunbar, an Anchorage Democrat who chairs the Senate's Health and Social Services Committee, says that funding comes with limits to what it can be spent on and when.
Particularly because there were Medicaid cuts and other funding cuts associated with HR 1, it's not clear that that money can go where it's most needed. It's not a huge amount of money relative to the challenges we face.
The Department of Health says it received nearly 1,800 proposals for how to spend the first round of federal funding. One major limit is the funding can't be used to construct or expand healthcare facilities like hospitals or badly needed housing for healthcare workers. Another is the timing. The first round of funds has to be allocated by the end of September and fully spent within the following year. The legislature's healthcare liaison told lawmakers that short timeline is challenging in rural Alaska, where a missed barge delivery or poor weather can lead to long delays. Another source of heartburn is a series of commitments the State Department of Health made in its application to the federal government. It said the legislature would pass a series of license compacts, which make it easier for healthcare providers from outside the state to practice in Alaska. A compact for nurses has been especially controversial, and it's unclear how much money could be clawed back if the legislature doesn't pass the compact by the end of 2027. Representative Genevieve Mina, an Anchorage Democrat and the resolution's main sponsor, said during a floor debate in March the legislature needed more information as it weighs the pros and cons.
We want more clarity on what these provisions would mean in terms of the award that we currently have and the money that we lose. We don't have that guidance right now, so this resolution urges more clarity on that.
Lawmakers have yet to pass any of the license compact bills, and the end of the legislative session is fast approaching. The resolution says the legislature is committed to the goals of the program and calls on the governor and Alaska's congressional delegation to push for clarity and flexibility. And as a resolution, it cannot be vetoed. The Alaska legislature voted last week to mandate a statewide three-step disaster evacuation scale. The Alaska Beacon reports that the move was inspired in part by a miscommunication in a wildfire near Denali National Park. The bill would require that state and local officials use the terms ready, set, and go, defined on maps by the colors green, yellow, and red, when providing public information about evacuations from the path of a disaster. The Ready, Set, Go program is already in broad use within Alaska, but not universally. The Senate already passed the bill unanimously in April, so it now goes to Governor Mike Dunleavy for final approval or veto. Last summer, a giant landslide in southeast Alaska triggered a tsunami nearly as high as the One World Trade Center building in New York City. Researchers spent months studying the event. In a new paper, they conclude the landslide tsunami was the second largest on record. And they warn that these events could become more common as the landscape shifts with climate change. As Avery Elfeld reports for the Alaska Desk, that spells trouble for those who work and play in Alaska's pristine fjords, including the cruise industry.
Brettwood Higman has spent years scouring Alaska's mountains for signs of potential landslides. One place he looked was the Tracy Arm Fjord, a popular cruise destination between Juneau and Petersburg.
I did actually look there.
But he didn't see any red flags. So Higman was caught completely off guard when a mountainside collapsed into the fjord early one morning last August. It generated one of the largest landslide tsunamis in recorded history. Experts say it would have been unsurvivable if any boats had been there.
I have tried to, encourage encourage my colleagues to look at this and explicitly acknowledge it as a failure. We clearly did not identify this beforehand.
The shock of it all underscores how hard it is to monitor for and predict these types of events, and that there's a long way to go before experts can do so reliably. It also shows the widespread nature of the risk, which is growing with climate change.
We have lots of slopes that we are worried about in Alaska that are failing because of a retreating glacier.
That's Ezgi Korososen, a research seismologist with the Alaska Earthquake Center.
In a sense that we were all caught off guard says a lot about these hazards, and we should be acting more quickly on that.
Higman and Korososen are among more than a dozen experts who spent months studying the August 10 event. In a paper published Wednesday in the journal Science, they answered a long list of questions about the tsunami, including its historic size. Perhaps most important, though, are answers around what might have caused the giant landslide that generated the tsunami. Those could be used to pinpoint new spots where similar slides might happen down the line, Korososen says.
This event gave us some clues on that end.
One telltale sign is something called deformation. That's when a slope's bedrock starts cracking and shifting. Notably, that wasn't really happening at the site of the landslide, which is why it hadn't set off alarm bells. But the new research pinpointed a few things that were happening. For starters, Higman says, a glacier at the base of the mountain in question had retreated rapidly in the weeks leading up to the slide, newly exposing the base of the slope.
The result of that would be that those slopes are not able to hold themselves up when there isn't a glacier there.
There were other factors, too. When the researchers looked back at data from the hours before the landslide, they noticed seismic activity that looked like small, distinctive earthquakes happening over and over again. There was also a heavy bout of rain. Higman says a stronger grasp on those factors and what they mean could help experts catch the next landslide tsunami before it happens.
In this case, it could have given us over a day of warning, plenty of time for vessels to get out of the way. Yeah, that's pretty attractive.
It's only becoming more important, he says, as glaciers recede and precipitation intensifies with climate change. Reporting in Haines, I'm Avery Elfelt.
As the war in Iran stretches on, many veterans are reflecting on past wars and weighing the risks ahead. Shelby Herbert spoke to some of them in Fairbanks, a regional military hub. As she reports for the Alaska Desk, they're responding to the new war in the Middle East with a mix of concern, skepticism, and caution.
In 1979, Fairbanks Army veteran Daryl Frank packed his bags for a deployment to Iran that never came. He was part of the Division Ready Force at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. His unit was preparing to parachute into the Middle East during the Iran hostage crisis.
We had all our gear ready, and we got the call to go to the airport, and they took us into this area with barbed wire and armed guards walking around it so nobody would run away. Either way, it would have been a battle. So anyway, we signed up for it, and we were like, yeah, this is what we've been training for.
The orders got called off. The hostages eventually were released, but the crisis marked a new era of hostility between the U.S. and Iran's then-new theocratic government. Daryl Frank is now retired from the Army and is the president of the Alaska Native Veterans Association. As he sipped coffee at the River City Cafe in Fairbanks, he said today's service members are facing a much more advanced Iranian military.
All through the years, they've acquired these weapons and whatnot. They didn't have the missile technology back then, or guided missiles, or anything like that.
Frank says his thoughts lie with the service members deployed to the area. He hopes they come home safely, with their heads held high, and without what he calls a moral injury.
You go in there knowing that that's what you signed up for, and no regrets going into a strange land. But it's a hell of a lot better than staying here and fighting it on your homeland, which is eventually going to happen one of these days.
Alaska has the largest concentration of veterans in the country, and Alaska Natives have the highest rate of service among any demographic. But sometimes it's a complicated relationship with the United States government. Some Alaska Natives joined the military decades ago after growing up in boarding schools intended to forcibly assimilate them.
We as Alaska Native people are still dealing with that, still recovering from that.
Alaska Native Veterans Association member Hugh Walker served in the Navy in the 70s. He says getting separated from his family and culture as a kid informs his feelings about the Iran War and about President Trump.
I just think it's a racist war. Not only that, but, you know, with his immigration policy, mostly brown people. And that really affects me because I'm a product of the boarding home.
At a Fairbanks No Kings rally in March, veteran Scott Justison weaved through the crowd, dressed in his old army camouflage and a T-Rex mask, handing out copies of his zine, The American Regressive. He served from 2005 to 2012 and deployed to Iraq.
So I joined under the George W. Bush administration after we had already invaded Iraq. And I wanted to learn about the human side of the military. There's the tendency on one side to dehumanize the members of the military as though they're kind of, I don't know, beasts that want to go out and commit violence.
He opposes the war in Iran and knows it isn't popular with Americans. But he hopes people don't take it out on the troops.
So some of my friends are in there because they have family, they have debt. You're not going to just quit based on your values if you're entrenched in debt and stuff. And so they try to make the best of it in a day-to-day compromise, like we all do in one capacity or another.
Though President Trump has declared the Iran war over, thousands of U.S. troops who deployed to the region remain there. Justison says he fears the war in Iran could become another years-long Middle Eastern entanglement, just like the war he served in. Reporting in Fairbanks, I'm Shelby Herbert.
For decades, Alaskans have peeled open paper pull tabs in bars and bingo halls across the state. Now, lawmakers are debating whether electronic pull tabs should be added to the mix. The debate comes as increasing costs and decreasing demand are hurting nonprofits that benefit from the games. KNOM's Ben Townsend reports.
Paper pull tabs haven't changed much over the years. Most are two layers of paper about the size of a credit card sandwiched together. Layers rip small, perforated windows to reveal colorful combinations of fruits or figures. Just the right combination could land you $300. It's a game of chance. Some strike gold, others count their losses. But the operator always wins, with the odds engineered to make enough to cover the cost of the game and leave a little left over. Those leftovers go to nonprofits under 1960's Alaska Charitable Gaming Act. Over half a century later, the paper pull tab's much younger brother, the E-Tab, wants to play too.
So the concept about modernizing pull tabs or rippies has been around for quite a while.
This is Senator Jesse Bjorkman, a Republican from the Kiski. He's sponsoring a bill that would overhaul the state's pull tab laws.
But the need, as costs for labor, insurance, and then the paper pull tab costs themselves for the paper tickets, really has eroded charities and nonprofits' ability to make money from charitable gaming.
Most pull tabs sell for $1, and depending on the game, about 85 cents go back to the players as prizes. The other 15 cents are split between a designated nonprofit, the distributor, and the venue that sold the pull tab. In this scenario, the state also collects a fifth of a penny as tax. Bjorkman says increased shipping costs for the heavy paper product is putting a squeeze on money going to nonprofits, and statewide, overall revenue is trending down. According to the Alaska Department of Revenue, the amount going to nonprofits peaked at just over $30 million in 2022. It was down about $8.5 million in 2024. Rather than shipping massive pallets of paper, the e-tabs would run on tablet computers. Think an iPad. People would buy a number of plays and tap, tap, tap until they're out of turns. But don't call it gambling, Bjorkman says.
I think it's very important for people to know and rest assured that we are not expanding gambling with this bill.
Senator Jesse Kiel, a Democrat from Juneau, disagrees.
Fundamentally, I have an objection to the bill's expansion of gambling in Alaska. of adding a newer, more addictive method with the screens. I have spoken with the sponsor. He's not caught by surprise here, but this bill has a long way to go, more opportunities to work on it.
Matt Fisher runs Alaska Wholesale, a Saldatna-based distributor of pull tabs.
My dad started this business 30 years ago. He was a paper guy. A lot of the paper players are getting older, and the younger players, they've already got a phone in their pocket that they have access to an online casino.
The U.S. Supreme Court legalized sports betting in 2018. In the 5 years that followed, Americans' spending on online sports betting ballooned from $5 to over $120 billion a year, according to the Journal of the American Medical Association. Sports betting is illegal in Alaska, but some platforms exploit loopholes to reach people in the state.
So what you'll see is they're popping their phone out and they are playing some type of game that isn't generating any money for nonprofits in Alaska. And it's going to some international gambling outfit.
Fisher is an advocate for Bjorkman's bill. He says by eliminating the cost of paper tickets, the games can pay out more to players and nonprofits.
And so what the ETABS does is it allows that entertainment to be in the bar, and the bar generates a little bit of revenue. The nonprofits generate a whole lot of revenue. What we can do with this is amazing.
The bill would also allow charitable gaming on Alaska Marine Highway System ferries, which Bjorkman says would supplement revenue from fares. Co-chair of the House Finance Committee, Neil Foster, says this bill is one of hundreds he's seen since this group of lawmakers first convened last year. At the end of April, he thought it was likely to die when the regular legislative session ends on May 20th.
I just don't see it making it through the entire process.
In fact, Bjorkman's bill has been ripe since the end of March for the full Senate to send it to the House. Bjorkman wasn't immediately available to comment on why it stalled or why now, about 7 weeks later, his bill is moving again. With reporting from Juneau, I'm Ben Townsend in Nome.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the 11th day of May, the year 2026. The sun rose today at 5:54. It will set again at 10:19. That will give us 16 hours and 25 minutes of glorious daylight, a gain of 4 minutes and 17 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high temperature for this date was 66, set in 2014, and our record low was 27, set in 1964. It is currently 43 degrees in Kodiak. It is overcast and breezy. At the airport, they indicate they have southeast winds steady at 21 miles per hour, gusting to 30, and 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for rain for the rest of the day, overnight tonight until about 10 a.m. tomorrow morning, followed by scattered showers. That rain could be especially heavy at times tonight. Look for a high near 44 today with southeast winds 20, gusting to 25. Overnight low tonight of just 42, east winds 20 to 25, gusting to 35. And for tomorrow, look for a high near 47, southeast winds 5 to 10. For Wednesday, they are saying showers are likely. Look for showers on Thursday, a chance of showers on Friday, showers on Saturday and Sunday as well. Mariners, be aware we have a small craft advisory through Tuesday for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles, southeast 25, becoming east 30 tonight, 6 foot seas, building to 9 feet tonight on our east side. For tomorrow, south 15 and 8 foot seas. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory tonight there, east increasing to 20 knots today, seas to 5 feet, east winds to 30 knots tonight with 7 foot seas. And for tomorrow, east 20 in the morning, becoming variable 10 with seas at 3 feet. Wednesday through Thursday, northeast 15 with 4 foot seas. Just outside of the city of Kodiak in Chiniak Bay, small craft advisory tonight with south winds becoming southeast 20 this afternoon, 3 foot seas, building to 7 feet this afternoon. For tonight, east 25 and 9-foot seas. And for tomorrow, southeast 10, seas coming all the way down to 3 feet. The Kodiak State Park Citizens Advisory Board is meeting tonight at 6 p.m. at the Fort Abercrombie State Park office. It's a chance to learn more and be an advocate for Island State Parks. A board seat is available. Again, that meeting, 6 p.m. tonight at the Fort Abercrombie State Park office. The Planning and Zoning Commission will be having a work session on Wednesday in the Borough Assembly Chambers at 6:30 p.m. And the Kodiak Island Borough Assembly will be having a work session in the Borough Assembly Chambers also at 6:30 p.m. That's on Thursday. Both meetings are open to the public, and the packets are available on the Kodiak Island Borough's website. Contact the Borough Clerk's office at 907-486-9310 with any questions. The Kodiak City Council will be holding a work session tomorrow in the Kodiak Public Library's multipurpose room. That meeting will begin at 5:30 p.m. They will also be having a budget work session on Thursday in the Kodiak Public Library's multipurpose room, which will begin at 5:30 p.m., immediately followed by a regular meeting at 6:30 p.m. And on Saturday, the Kodiak City Council will be holding a sales tax work session. That meeting will begin at 10 a.m., and that will be held in the City Hall Conference Room. All these meetings are open to the public. It will be web-streamed. The link for that and the meeting packets are available at the City of Kodiak website. If you need more information, contact the city clerk at 486-8636. The Kodiak Regional Aquaculture Association will be holding its annual meeting on Thursday, beginning at 9:30 a.m. at the KRAA offices. The board of directors will be presented with board member election results and seat any new board members, as well as review programs and plans for the upcoming salmon season. Members of the public are welcome. Again, that's 9:30 a.m. on Thursday at the KRAA offices. This is just in. The Kodiak Chamber of Commerce and Kodiak NOAA Lab will be holding a reception for a visit from NOAA Fisheries leadership, including Eugenio Pinheiro Soler, Assistant Administrator of NOAA Fisheries. That means he is the head of NOAA Fisheries. He'll be joined by John Kirkland, who is the Alaska Regional Administrator, and Dr. Robert Foy, Professor Emeritus, Alaska Fisheries Science Center Director. That reception will be on Friday, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Kodiak Fisheries Research Center. That's the Touch Tank building over on Near Island. Again, that's Friday, 7:30 at the Touch Tank building. Fisheries Bigwigs. It's trivia time this Wednesday, the Kodiak Island Brewing and Still, another KMXT trivia night at the brewery. Same rules as usual, $10 per person. You can play as an individual or a group. 6:30 p.m. with a Crab Fest-themed trivia at the Kodiak Island Brewing and Still on Wednesday. Also, KMXT is turning 50 in 2026, and we're making a yearbook. If you'd like to submit a photo and help tell a story of KMXT through the people who bring it to life, well, you belong in this book. KMXT members, please send us landscape photos of you and your family, including everyone's names, and send your photos by June 30th. And also, my pages are sticking together. KMXT Kodiak Moments 2027 calendar submissions are open now. Photos are limited to 3 per person. Submit them at kmxt.org.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.